Oh, are you recording, Tim? It doesn't. Oh, there we go.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Molly Glover, Nick Glover, and Tim Wick.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks without God.
This week on Geeks Without God, our guest is movie critic Alan Cerny from the website Vital Thrills. We talk with him about a bunch of stuff, including about how movies are kind of like religion to him.
We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I'm your host, Molly Glover, joined as always by my co-hosts, Nick Glover.
Hi.
And Tim Wick.
Hello.
And today we have a very exciting guest. We are very pleased to welcome Alan Cerny.
Hi, how is everybody?
We're good. Hey. Hi, Alan.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much. So you are a movie writer.
Yes, I started writing movie reviews for a website called Ain't It Cool News, and then I left that site and started writing for comingsoon.net. And then most recently, I'm writing for a website called Vital Thrills. Haven't written much lately, but my last review was The King of Staten Island. I reviewed that a few weeks ago.
Oh, nice. Sure. Nice.
And some other stuff. And the Beastie Boys story, I reviewed that.
Cool.
Yeah, so if you want to, and I'm on Rotten Tomatoes. So if you want to look me up on Rotten Tomatoes, you'll find a lot of the reviews I wrote for Coming Soon and for Vital Thrills there.
That's awesome. How did you just kind of stumble into movie writing, or was it something you always wanted to do?
I've been a movie geek since I was 5 years old, and Jaws, saw Jaws in the movie theater. My whole family and I went, and when I say family, I mean everybody, my cousins, my aunts, my uncles, because my
awesome.
Family is a lot of fisher people.
Yeah.
So Jaws is like the ultimate fisher story. So, I remember really clearly telling my dad that he had to tell me when the scary parts were going to come. And of course he didn't. And, so that movie kind of changed everything. And, you know, the first thing I did after getting out of that movie is go into my library and, try and grab books on sharks. And then after that, I started grabbing books on filmmaking, and then that kind of went from there. And then Star Wars 2 years later. And then, you know, I was on my way.
Yeah. No kidding. Yeah. What a time to be like a kid. And seeing all these like absolute cinematic masterpieces, that would absolutely fuel the fire.
Yeah, you know, these days we're with an abundance of great stuff, and it's kind of hard to find that. You know, it's not hard to find joy in the stuff, but it's like when something like Jaws or Star Wars just kind of changed the paradigm forever for you as a geek, and you know when that stuff dropped. Now that stuff drops like every day. Or every week,
right.
You know, and I don't know if people understand just how life-changing that stuff could be, but you know, people still find that stuff and it still changes their lives. And you know, so you know, everybody has their fun thing, and movies are mine.
Was there ever a point as a movie writer where you found like your enthusiasm for films waning a little bit just because you were thinking of them in a more critical light and you couldn't just sit in a movie theater and go, hot damn, I'm watching a new Star Wars movie.
Yeah, you know, it depends on the movie I'm watching. It's really, really hard for me to put a critical hat on for Star Wars, for example. although this last one, I certainly did because I hated it. For certain movies, it's kind of hard for me to do that. But certain movies, I can. I've decided that I don't want to really have a critical hat. I want to watch the movie and have the reaction that I have the reaction. I don't want to pick it apart for every little thing. Because that's not the journey that most people take when they watch a movie. They let the experience kind of wash over them and they get involved in the story and the characters. If the movie lets you in, and it, you know, I've always said this is a really corny thing to say, but I always thought movies were doors, not windows. You could look out a window, but you walk through a door.
Oh, I love that.
And that's kind of the way I look at film. And if the film doesn't let me in, then I can be critical. But, you know, if a film lets me in and I kind of join the world and the characters and the plot, then, you know, that's the kind of reviews that I like to write. I don't want to write. I'm not clinical and I'm not really technical. I write kind of from a place of emotion. If something has affected me, then I'm going to acknowledge that, and hopefully people will read that and come to that conclusion too.
Yeah. So you're also an atheist, agnostic. Back, you said you go
non-believer.
Back. Non-believer. Yeah. Back. Yep. In, depends on the day, right? But
really,
were there any movies that led you down that path?
It's interesting. I went to Catholic school. I grew up Catholic. I went to Catholic school from elementary school to all through high school.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
I went to
the whole kit and caboodle.
I sure did. And that was coming from my grandmother, because my grandmother insisted to my dad that they raised us Catholic. So I went to St. Rose of Lima Catholic school from kindergarten to fifth. Then 6th through 8th, I went to Seton Catholic Junior High. And then from 9th to 12th, graduated, and I went to St. Pius the 10th. Even when I went to college, I went to St. Thomas University for a year. So, but it never, and I mean, people have always asked me, well, when did you fall off the wagon? I don't know if I was really ever on the wagon, because I kept questioning everything in church, you know, like the idea of the body and the blood of Christ, and it's like, well, it's bread and wine, you know, and I didn't do it there are a few things that kind of made me kind of fall out of faith, but it was never all that strong a hold on me anyway. I mean, I always thought the rituals of the Catholic Church were, you know, kind of odd. Although all the experiences with people are going to say what they say, but all the experiences with priests I've ever had, I've always enjoyed the company of talking, you know, like my favorite teacher was my Father White in high school, because a lot of the priests that I'd talked to had critical thinking. Even the theology class I took in high school, I loved it because it was more of a history thing than actually theology, because Father Mike would say, oh, this Pope was terrible. Oh, this Pope was, he did this. I mean, he was actually really quite honest about it.
There's a big difference, I think, between priests who are basically at a church, in charge of a church and doing sermons and that kind of work, and the ones who teach. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like, I think that I guess I'd have to look up statistics, but I wonder how many of the ones that are teachers are, you know, fuck faces, or if they're, or if it's like less so, you know, because like I went to Catholic college and we had some nuns who taught too, and they were very level-headed, you know, very rational for considering that they had devoted their life to, you know, a religion.
Yeah. Father Mike was interesting. He was the theology teacher in my senior year. One of the projects that we were required to do in senior year was this is the year that the movie The Mission came out. And he ordered all of us to go see the movie. I love The Mission. It's a great movie. I love a lot of religious movies, to be honest. And he had us write an essay on it and everything. And then I remember after I graduated, The Last Temptation of Christ came out. And I still kept in contact with Father Mike. So I visited school one day and I said, hey, I went and saw Last Temptation of Christ. And he's like really curious. Like, what did you think of it? And, so I said, I thought it was actually a really great spiritual film. And you know, I don't know why you guys are so upset about it. And he goes, honestly, I'd go see it myself if I wasn't, if I could get away with it.
Yeah. You know?
So, I always thought that was fascinating.
Do you think that, because you fell in love with, you know, movies and like, which is, you know, a geekery really, right? Especially like Jaws and Star Wars, and just, you know, you're obviously an inquisitive kid. If the first thing you do is go learn, right, about after you see a movie, do you think that it wasn't that geekiness kind of also, you know, led to the non-belief or led to the questioning? Are they just kind of part and parcel?
I always kind of just questioned it. I never had a movie or any cinematic experience really that kind of made me question my faith. I just or lack of it. I just I went to the church, but I never felt I never felt that connection. Right? I could look to the people right and left of me, and I could either they're faking it really well, or they felt that connection, and I just didn't. It wasn't something that connected with me. I get more spiritual satisfaction from a satisfying story.
That was going to be my next question, was do movies provide that spiritual experience?
They do. They do. Like I said, I just watched one of my favorite movies. I have a podcast as well called Matinee Heroes. I do it with a friend of mine. And we basically talk about heroic cinema, and, you know, not just superhero movies, but like action adventure movies, mm-hmm. stuff like that, but also how to apply that heroism in life. And we just covered a movie for my birthday, because it's one of my all-time favorite movies. It's called Angels with Dirty Faces with James Cagney and Pat O'Brien. And I love that movie, and it's very spiritual. It's very religious. It's very Catholic. But at the same time, I watch that film and I'm thinking, well, there's a catharsis that's a genuine, and it doesn't matter how they come to it, mm. if it's through faith or if it's through, you know, inspiration, art, or something like that. If you are, that's why I'm atheist and agnostic, but I'm not one of those people who like wants to tell people how to think. Although if they ask me my opinion, I'm going to tell them. but for the most part, if you come to a place of peace and you come to a place of knowledge, and you treat people better through a cathartic experience, and whether or not it's through religion or art or anything, then that's always a benefit.
That kind of growth and fulfillment isn't something that religion has a monopoly on.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I've really never found it in religion, but other people might, you know, and I've always found it through movies and books and art. So that's kind of where I came from.
Is anyone else in your family a non-believer, or are they all still
Catholic?
Yeah, you're it.
Yeah,
how,
I'm it.
Do they know?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
How do you guys talk about it?
We don't.
Yeah. Good Catholics. That's the Catholic way. Let's just not talk about it.
Well, you know, it's, I'll get the occasional Facebook post from my sister's very, very devout. So I get the occasional Facebook post where she'll talk about this and she'll post something. I'm just like, oh, I'll just scroll past. We'll just scroll past.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had conversations before, mostly geared towards the abortion debate, because she's very, very staunchly anti-abortion, and I'm not, you know, and mm-hmm. She's tried to come at that angle, you know, that a lot of people in that argument want to talk about. It's like, how do you feel about killing babies and things like that? And it's like, that stuff's not going to work on me. First, I'm your brother and you know better than that.
Yeah.
That's not the way I think. But you know, I am, you know, the rights of a woman's body are more important than anything. And you can come at me from that angle. I'm just going to ignore you. You know, people who nag me, people who try to insist on a certain way, I normally blow them off. It's the people that want, if you want me to get me to do something, don't nag me. So
that explains why religion didn't take.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
Pretty much. Not a fan of authoritarian nagging.
Every Sunday they nag.
It's their whole deal is nagging.
Yeah.
So, Tim, how do you and Alan know each other?
Well, this is a good.
Yeah, I mean, Alan wrote for Ain't It Cool News.
Right.
And I used to go to Butnamathon, as you recall,
sure.
When that was a thing. And obviously so did Alan. Everybody who was writing for Ain't It Cool News would be at Butnamathon unless they couldn't be there. So I mean, we knew each other all right through then. I think we've actually gotten to know each other more, like oddly via Facebook.
Yeah.
And then at Butnamathon. I was I really enjoyed Butnamathon, and I enjoyed hanging out with people at Butnamathon. But when I was usually in the theater, I was pretty quiet because I'm not a let's all stand around and talk about the movie as soon as it's over kind of guy, which drives Pat nuts that I'm not, you know, we'll be driving home from a movie and she'll be like processing it. And I'm like, I'm going to be ready to talk about this in 12 hours. and that's how I kind of was at Butnamathon. It's like, we'd finish with a movie and I'd just kind of be sitting in my seat going, all right, well, I need to kind of stew on this movie for the 10, 15 minutes I have before the next movie. But
but
that's where, I mean, we were all in that room together, and that's
sure.
the first time that Alan and I got exposed to one another. And then I think there was more communication after things went, what do we want to say, south?
Very south.
After after things went very south.
Yeah.
And we've talked about what happened as far as information that came out about Harry, mm-hmm. and how a lot of us who knew him processed that.
Yeah. I mean, that whole period of time was, I'm still kind of struggling with it. I cherish the friendships that I formed through all of it. I mean, I got some lifelong great friends through it.
Yeah. But
when everything happened, I don't live in Austin. I'm a writer. I was a writer for the site, and I felt like I knew everybody pretty well. And then all this stuff came down, mm-hmm. and just kind of shocked and appalled me, and it appalled everybody. And but you know, I've got friends with Tim and Wendy Bowlesby and mm-hmm. C. Robert Cargill, mm-hmm. and a lot of those people are close friends of mine. And I mean, like this last Christmas, we rented a house and watched a bunch of movies, and
sure.
That was a lot of fun. I don't think that's going to happen this year, unfortunately.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, I mean, those friendships I hold very, very strongly. And the lessons that I took from Ain't It Cool are, you know, I still have value to them, even with the people that I was dealing, you know, with, well, person really, because most everybody else was great. But his, what he had done and kind of really, well, it felt like it made our relationships and our bonds even kind of stronger, because it didn't kill mm-hmm. our enthusiasm.
Mm-hmm.
It's mm-hmm. just that, you know, he's not a part of it anymore. And
yeah, it's interesting. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
We have so many friends that used to go to Buttonhamathon, Molly and I, that we have never gone, but you know, the Bowlesbys, Cargill, Tim mm-hmm. and Pat, I guess.
Jeremy,
I could just name names. Melissa,
drop them all.
Yeah, we have a ton of friends that go, and Molly and I were gearing up. We're like, you know what? Next year, let's apply. Next year, let's apply. Let's see if we can't go for the first time with a bunch of friends. We'll go check it out. That was the year there was no Buttonhamathon.
Well, it's interesting. The reason I bring it up, honestly, is because I think that there's a lot of parallels with this has happened in lots of geek circles, right? Where all of a sudden we find out somebody that we were all close to that we really didn't think was a bad guy, but in hindsight you're like, oh, all those surface behaviors, you're like, fuck, those are all showing something else. I think there's a lot that goes on there at the Catholic Church. And I think that it can help us to understand how people can stay Catholic, you know, when this is happening, because they feel like they've got these bonds with their community and they think it doesn't really affect them. You know, they still have lifelong connections and commitments. And I was thinking about that the other day, and how it's hard to unlearn your community. And I think that with the Catholic Church, people aren't wanting to recognize how systemic it is, as opposed to one bad actor.
Yeah. The thing about Ain't It Cool was that you felt like you were part of the cool kids, right? Mm-hmm. You really did. And you don't see outside of it. You don't see how exclusionary it is. You don't see how much of a gatekeeping it is, really.
Because you're in. You're on the inside.
Yeah, because you're in. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yep.
And when you get out of it and you realize, God, I was not at my best when I was in there, right? Mm. You know, I feel like I'm at my best when it comes to general geek stuff and writing and everything. I feel pretty good, confident about that. But I the relationships that I filmed, that I formed through Buttonhamathon and Ain't It Cool, I really value them a ton. But, you know, when people were kind of biting from outside or knocking on the door from outside and saying, hey, this isn't quite right, you don't put a lot of stock in it, because, you know, you enjoy the drugs that they're feeding you, right? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And I think that's the same way for the Catholic Church. You know, it's very much the communities. And I mean, I think that's just general in religion altogether. It's the communities that keep people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, communities shouldn't be about the organization, but the general bonding that you film with that you form with people. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm friends with Tim and I'm friends with Cargill and all that. But I think our friendship started, we got it through the door because of general geekiness. But afterwards, it's because these are good people and I want to know them. And you don't want to be that there's an organization that may have brought us together, but at the end, that's not the bond. That kind of goes by the wayside.
Yeah. I mean, I feel super fortunate that I got involved with that group of people. Even though that the catalyst for getting involved with that group of people was a bad catalyst, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the difference with a secular connection like we all have with that geek connection is that geek connection didn't go away just because that catalyst went away. And I think
you all quickly severed ties. Everyone I knew very swiftly, unequivocally came out and was like, nope, fuck Harry Knowles. We're done. Yeah. Like absolutely done. And so that I think is a big difference.
All of this kind of happened at an event that they had in Austin called Fantastic Fest, mm-hmm. which was founded by Harry Knowles and Tim League of the Alamo Draft House and a few other people. And when all this came down, that was a really, really tough weekend for me because, I mean, it's not my story to tell, but there are there are other things that have not exactly come to light. Okay. Sure, and I'm not, it's not my story to tell, so I'm not going to, but when I heard about all this other stuff, it's like, oh no, this dude is terrible and got to get away from him. And I want to make sure that it's not just to protect myself and my family, but just because I want to, I want people to look at me with integrity. I want to be the person that says, hey man, I'm not going to allow this to happen. And I, you know, when I was told, hey, this is what's going on, I made sure, hey, we're done with this. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, I feel really satisfied how I did it. I still miss a lot of it, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. So, but Numathon was a fun experience. Physically though, I don't think I could actually do But Numathon anymore. You know, 24 hours of movies is tough.
So. Oh, I could never do it. I always slept through something, but I think that the difference between religion and that community is really stark in that everybody kind of connected with each other and found a way to go, you know, we're all still into this. Mm-hmm. And it's just that this thing that brought us together, as opposed to religion, where religion really works very hard on saying, you need to be part of this to stay connected to all these people. And I mean, it's the Catholic Church might be a little less egregious as far as this is concerned. I mean, we had like somebody who was who used to be a
Jehovah's Witness,
and the way that the Jehovah's Witnesses cut you off from everybody in your life if you break from them is not the same way as the Catholic Church works. But at the same time, you know, religion is based around that weekly, let's all get together and go to church together. And that's what you do. And But Numathon was that way too, right? Well, let's all get together this one weekend of the year, which was really, you know, a long weekend where there were parties and shit. And then you all got together in a theater and watched movies for 24 hours. And then after you all went to sleep for 8 hours, you got together again to talk about them.
Right. Yeah.
But once that was removed, there was still a way for all of us to remain connected. But the minute you walk away from the Catholic Church, there is that thing of somebody like your sister still talking about it and feeling like that's your connection, which it isn't. I mean, your connection, right, is that you're siblings and that it doesn't have to be there at all. And I'm sure it doesn't happen all the time. But I think that can be the challenge that you face when you're leaving religion versus leaving Ain't It Cool News.
Alan, have you had conversations with your family about, for example, all the child abuse in the Catholic Church or anything like that? Do you know how they feel about it? Because I know Tim's mom is Catholic and she's obviously horrified by it and very outspoken about it, but at the same time, she's still a Catholic.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, anybody's familiar with the Catholic Church and Catholicism in general, people like to compartmentalize, or we'll call them cafeteria Catholics. You just take over here. You don't take from over here. And, you know,
Yeah, that's what my mom is. No question about it.
Yeah.
I love her to death, but that is true.
Yeah. And that's always been the same for everybody, I think. So, and when it comes to like the abuses of the Catholic Church, maybe it was happening in the church that I was at, but I never really saw anything like that. And I never really felt anything like that. So, I found out later that, one of the pastors at the church that I was in, went to elementary school. He was HIV positive and he ended up dying of AIDS. Hmm. But that was a real hush hush at the time, obviously, because it was the 80s. And so, the idea of the abuse, it may have happened. I'm sure there was one incident when I was in junior high school with one of the teachers there, the science teacher, and I don't know if he was a Catholic or not, but it was an incident with a student. And but I mean, that was he was let go immediately, and and that was really kind of brushed over.
So probably not a priest.
So probably your family probably has had similar experiences to you, where they haven't seen it, therefore it doesn't really exist. It exists in that kind of amorphous way where it's happening to other Catholics.
It's conceptual.
And it's not really something that they think about.
The cafeteria Catholics thing has always confused me so much, because if you're a cafeteria Catholic and you're just not going full tilt Catholic, aren't you basically a Protestant? Like, isn't that what like, you know, Lutheranism was, is basically saying like, yes, Christianity, but no, not those parts.
Well,
I mean,
I think every Catholic is a cafeteria Catholic, and I'll really tell you why. It's because most Catholic families don't have more than two or three kids, and you know. And if they were, totally Catholic, going into full on Catholicism, they would probably have six or seven.
Yeah,
right.
And so, I mean, somebody's practicing birth control somewhere.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of tend to think that most Catholics are cafeteria Catholics in a lot of ways.
Yeah,
and I mean, when it comes to like abortion, I think most Catholics are pretty staunchly pro-life.
Yeah.
You know, other things, I mean, the thing of that, I
you
always
know, maybe in your family, but but I got raised in a pretty hippy dippy Catholic church.
Where
I would argue probably most of the people in that church were pro-choice.
Yeah, I'm Texas of the South, so it's
sure.
Yeah.
That's a lot harder.
So, but I mean, the idea that I think the idea of no birth control scares a lot of people. So I think that they definitely do that. And one of
the
things
that
one of the things that I've always kind of admired about the Catholic Church is that there's an intellectual, at least in my experience, there is an intellectual curiosity that I don't see in a lot of other religions. Because they taught evolution in school. We learned all about that. In fact, you know, evolution is considered, Tim may speak to this as well. Evolution is considered a staple of science in the Catholic Church, because the general belief is that, this was from the very beginning, that Genesis, the book of Genesis in the Bible is not to be taken literally.
Mm-hmm.
The book of Revelations, I mean, everybody talks about the book of Revelations as telling the future, but I was taught that it was written by the Apostle John as basically a propaganda piece for all the Catholics Christians at the time were being basically hunted down by the Roman Empire. So it's like, oh no, we're going to come back and we're going to kick ass. And let me tell you how I wrote this piece about it.
Vatican has an official astronomer. There is a lot I don't like about the Catholic Church, and we don't have time to talk about all the things I don't like about the Catholic Church. But it is true. I mean, one of the things that they are really pretty advanced on is they accept science as real.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, their basic concept is, well, their basic concept. Yeah. To a point, you know, there's still Jesus, whatever. Anyway. But I mean, the whole idea that the laws of physics, the laws of nature were created by God, and therefore they exist.
Mm-hmm.
As science has discovered them, they exist. Now, I think they will argue the intelligent design. They're gonna argue that evolution did happen, but human evolution was nudged along by God. They're not going to go to the lengths that, say, the evangelicals will go to and say, look at the human eye. It's impossible to have evolved without God. No, they don't say that. They just say,
Anna,
you know,
fits right here.
Yeah. They just say, you know, evolution has happened, but God did help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Alan, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you. We're all stuck at home, and there's a wealth of media at our very fingertips. What are your what quarantine movies should we be watching? That maybe, like, what are your top picks? Like, give us some movies we should watch while we're
old
all quarantined.
Yeah.
What are you going to?
Well, a lot of comfort food movies for me. But I've also I try to watch something new every day, or try to watch something new every couple of days. I don't want to get in the same stuck routine and watch, because I could easily, and Tim probably could vouch, I could watch Lord of the Rings every day, all day, forever. You know,
well, why wouldn't you? Yeah.
Besides that, besides Star Wars, Jaws, and Lord of the Rings, what's another comfort movie you like?
So I try to watch new stuff, trying to watch new stuff. But the Beastie Boys story that's on Apple Plus, Apple TV is wonderful. If you're a fan of the band, you got to watch it because it's amazing.
Awesome.
The movie that I love King of Staten Island quite a bit.
We've
been looking forward to it.
I'm a big Apatow fan.
Yeah.
Waiting for the price to come down a little bit.
And, I've kind of dived in. So there's this game that's on PlayStation right now that just came out last week called Ghost of Tsushima, which is basically a samurai game.
Yeah,
I've been playing that nonstop because I'm a big samurai movie buff, and I've been watching those too. I love Kurosawa films, and a lot of those films I enjoy.
Did you like The Mandalorian?
I did. I loved it. I liked it a lot. I thought that it throws all the samurai tropes in there. The Western
wolf and
tropes
cub going on.
Yeah, it's all great. I'm really excited for the next season. But I had a lot of fun with that. That Dave Filoni, who basically does the Clone Wars and Mandalorian, they need to give him some movies, really, frankly.
Yeah,
and let him play with that universe a little bit. When I came out of Rise of Skywalker, I was so angry. I can't even tell you. I've seen all the other films, even the prequels, many times. I know the prequels aren't great, but there's things in them I like. But I can't find anything to like in Rise of Skywalker. I just can't. I'm already going down that rabbit hole just thinking about it. So.
Have you watched the behind the scenes, like behind the magic show for The Mandalorian?
Not yet. I want to watch that.
Dave Filoni in that.
Yeah, some of that stuff. You know, I've never been big on director's commentaries, and I like watching making of documentaries and stuff, but it depends on the film. Mm-hmm. A lot of that stuff takes away from the illusion for me.
They talk about the technology a lot, and the 3D screen where they did pre-viz for every single shot and every single like bit of the show. It lets them shoot so fast that it's like Taika Waititi said they shot like over 300 shots in a day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because of the new technology.
That stuff is really cool, but I've kind of made peace with the fact that I'm probably never going to make a movie. So I don't watch that stuff anymore. I mean, I used to when I was younger, I would devour every commentary and every making of doc.
I mean,
the cool thing about Blu-rays and DVDs is basically film school in a box if you want to have it go that way, you know. And a lot of the stuff, especially a lot of the Criterion stuff, you could just dive in and explore. And I like to have that option. But lately, I just don't really watch that stuff. I just watch the movies that I watch. I've been watching a lot of action films. I watched RoboCop a few times. There's this movie Tim will know. This is the last movie that I ever played, but Numathon. It's a movie called Hard Boiled by John Woo. I got a really, really – somebody – It's a bootleg, but somebody gave me a really, really nice restoration of it on Blu-ray. It's by a company named Hong Kong Rescue. So, telling people to go find a bootleg, but sure, go get it because it's amazing. It's the cleanest print I've ever seen. Wow. I've watched that so many times now. I mean, with all the crap that's going on with the police departments, it's kind of nice to watch a really
all this.
Yeah, it was just gesturing at all of the world.
All the full frame, all this.
The stuff.
I feel this is ASL, should be ASL for 2020.
Pretty much. But I mean, it's nice to watch a fun cop movie, even if it's in Hong Kong, and it's great. I've been watching that a lot. So if you want to find it, it's called, a website called Hong Kong Rescue. They're doing a lot of stuff. So.
Hard Boiled is the Wu film with the gunfight while they're like juggling the babies out of the hospital.
It's ridiculous.
It's so absurd and it's so just good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
people are ducking fireballs in hallways, and that's real people doing it. It's like somebody's got their. I mean, somebody got the back of their neck burned. And
the funniest thing about that experience, and this is a Numathon story, is one of the people in a crowd of people that we watched it with. There are a couple of women from North Carolina. I think it's North Carolina. Anyway, from the South, but they're ER nurses, and they both had worked in maternity, and they were just furious. They were furious because they're like, that is not how you handle a baby.
That's not how you handle a gun.
They're like, you got safety protocols, and they aren't following any of them.
Here's where it gets a little unbelievable. Yeah, Nobody should hold a baby that way.
But they're just like, you know, if they followed the proper protocols, none of this would be a problem.
Amazing.
It's funny. I played Hard Boiled for my birthday a few years ago. I'm friends with the programmer and director here in town at the Alamo Draft House. His name is Robert Salcedo, and we do something similar to Buttonumathon every year. We weren't able to do it this year, but we call it Hullabaloo, where we all pick movies to play that we don't tell anybody what we're playing. So we want to see the accents. It's a lot of fun. But for my birthday movie, I picked Hard Boiled, and I have a friend here in town. He's another film critic, and he's really sensitive about stuff like that. He doesn't want to. I mean, nobody wants to see like a dog die in a movie or a baby get killed.
Yeah, I can't.
And I told him when the movie started, I said, hey, there's a sequence with a bunch of babies. I just want you to know ahead of time. I'm not spoiling anything by telling you none of them die. Okay. They're going to be fine. And
no babies were harmed by making of Hard Boiled.
If I hadn't have told him that, I don't think he would have enjoyed the movie, because he would have been, you know, he would have been on pins and needles worrying about it. And I wanted to make sure that he knew that.
Yeah.
And sometimes when it comes to stuff like that, and people, I've changed my mind a lot on this, because when I first started talking about movies, it's like, no, the experience needs to be pure. People shouldn't spoil things.
Mm-hmm.
Now everybody's got so much trauma. Everybody suffers from something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if a movie's going to go there, that's fine. But I think it's okay to let people know, hey, this is the ride you're going to take. Some things happen here you should be prepared for. And I just think that that's a kinder, my 20-year-old self or 30-year-old self is like, no, you're ruining the cinematic experience.
Totally.
Yeah. I'm 50 years old now, and I think that people should be able to relax and enjoy a movie, and they should know what they're getting. You know, I Consumer Reports, why not?
I unfortunately saw the first John Wick right after I'd had to put my dog down of like 3 years, who was my best friend, man. And like that was real hard because I didn't know. Like none of us
first,
knew.
It's in the first 2 minutes.
It's real fast. I have a real bad time with it, especially when they put in like the little yipe or whatever that the animal makes that always just kills me. I have no problem with violence against humans, because I just, for some reason, I'm like, they're humans, they know what's happening at least, but like dogs, they don't know what's going on. They, you know, they just trusted whoever had the gun, and it makes me so mad.
Actually,
it's one of those things that the kids getting killed for like no reason, more because like it's edgy, really pisses me off. There was a movie we watched at Buttonumathon called High Tension or Switchblade Romance. I mean, there's a lot I can bitch about with that movie, but there's a kid, there's a point where there's a just like a, you know, a 6-7-year-old kid, and they kill him, and it just pissed me off, because I'm like, fuck that.
I can't enjoy a movie that does that.
You just killed the kid because you're like, ha-ha, we got a kid and we can kill him. That shows how bad the serial killer is, because they just killed this kid.
Yeah.
And this
serial killer kills kids, motherfucker. He doesn't give a fuck.
And it just bugs me, because I feel like it's cheap.
It's cheap, and they want to be edgy, and I hate that crap too. And it's funny, because that director, he made a movie last year that was like ended up being one of my favorite films of the year, which was Crawl.
Crawl?
It's great. Yeah.
Oh, I heard about it, but I didn't see it. Yeah.
And so just so you understand going in that it's a total thrill ride. They don't do cheap stuff like that. You know, there's even a dog in it that doesn't get killed.
Crawl,
I'll tell you that.
Crawl is the one with the alligators, right?
The flooded house.
It's
so well made and well crafted. It's not the same guy that made High Tension at all. So maybe the guy's mellowed out or improved as a filmmaker over the years. So,
well, what I loved about that movie when we saw the trailers was everybody up north that I know was like, what is this implausible fucking bullshit? And our friend Ron, who's from Florida, was like, oh no, fuck that. That movie looks terrifying. No, that shit can happen.
It's not implausible at all, because everybody goes back to their flooded house.
Yep, that's
the way it is. So.
Awesome. Well, Alan, this has been great. I think it's time to move on to five questions.
Five questions.
Yeah, you ready? All right.
I'm ready.
Nick, what's question one?
Question one is, what conspiracy theory do you find most interesting or compelling? It doesn't have to be something you believe, but maybe just entertainment value or intrigue.
You know, I'm going to have to go with the very first, the original one, which is the JFK assassination. You know, I logically know that, yes, it could have been one guy, but I mean, Oliver Stone kind of convinced me it could be otherwise. You know, there's a lot of weird stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff. And watching that movie and then reading on it, because I read so few of the books afterwards, and you know, it's, I don't know if it happened. I still don't. I mean, I don't subscribe to conspiracy theories in general, but that I still, you know, when they say the lone gun theory, I'm going, well,
sure, were a lot of suicides afterward, but a lot of people that didn't ever want to commit suicide.
Yeah.
It's kind of the gold standard for a good, like, plausible conspiracy.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, the whole Jack Ruby thing is weird, and like you said, there's a lot of people that died afterwards, and it's
people who got cancer who didn't have any. Yeah, all kind. I read a big book about that too when I was little, and it really imprinted on me. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I think that there's. I mean, I don't know what to think still. I mean, people will tell me the single shooter theory all day, but the magic bullet thing is like, no, that doesn't happen. The laws of physics don't allow that to happen. So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, cool. Tim, question two.
Question number two. What is your ideal 2-week vacation? Money is no object, but physics is a limiting factor.
You know, I'm going to piss some of my friends off by saying this, but I don't like going on vacation with friends. I mean, every time I've done it, I've come away with, I've just had a lousy time. My favorite vacation I ever took was going to New York for 4 days with my wife and daughter. And we went to Broadway shows and walked the streets and ate really good food in Hell's Kitchen. And honestly, if I had 2 weeks to go back there, especially right now, it'd probably be great.
Well, you couldn't watch Broadway shows.
No, that's true. That's true. You can't watch Broadway. So maybe Broadway would
be back. Or eat in Hell's Kitchen.
That's true. All the stuff I would want to do, I can't do. That's true. So
next year.
Yeah, next year. So if I had 2 weeks, honestly, I would just go with my wife and daughter and go to New York and enjoy that again. If I had money was no object, any Broadway show I wanted to get into, we would go and eat great food and go to the Statue of Liberty. Remember when we had Liberty once?
Stay in one of those super fancy Upper West Side hotels, right? Yeah.
The last time we were there, we stayed in Times Square, which is probably really touristy, but the hotel was really nice.
Yeah.
And you don't want to eat in Times Square because it's all franchise food. You want to leave and go other places. But I just had an amazing time. So if I was gonna have 2 weeks, it would be there. If it wasn't there, it would probably be England, and I would kind of just explore the historical stuff in England. I would enjoy that too.
When you go back to New York, go to the New Yorker Hotel because Tesla lived there, and you can go see Tesla's room, and it's really great.
Oh, that would be cool. That would be really cool. We should do that.
Yeah,
we're gonna go back. We're gonna go back. We've had too much fun. And like I said, when I would go with other family members and or other friends, their agendas on their trip were not mine, and I just didn't enjoy myself.
You got to have the right people to travel with. The aforementioned Wendy Bowlesby is about the only friend of mine that I have that we are compatible travelers.
All right, Nick, question three.
Travelers.
Yeah.
Question three is, what's a movie or a book that changed your life, and how or why?
So Tim probably knows this story.
Probably.
But that movie would be E.T.
Ooh.
There's a story involved there. So E.T. was the, I wrote a big article about it for Andy Cool, for the 20th anniversary. And E.T. was the most formative film of my life. It was one of the films I saw with my friends, and it was one of those great bonding experiences. I don't really talk to any of those people anymore, but at the time it was one of those great bonding experiences. And then, a couple of weeks later, my mom was having a Tupperware party at the house. And she kicked me and my dad out of the house saying, well, we're having all these people over. Y'all need to go find something else to do. So we went to go get cheeseburgers. And then dad said, you want to go to a movie? And I said, yeah, let's go to E.T. And he goes, well, you've seen it already. And I said, you haven't seen it, so I want to take you to see it. So we went and saw it. And watching the movie, and that movie will always make me cry every time, no problem. I've seen it 100 times, and every time I cry. Well, you know, E.T. gets sick and dies, and I'm kind of tearing up as I normally do. I was 12 years old at the time. I turned around and looked at my dad, and my dad is crying too. That's the first time I ever saw him cry.
That's a big deal.
And after that, it kind of changed our relationship quite a bit. And it turns out my dad died when I was 17. I saw the movie when I was 12. That was really the only movie that me and him ever saw together, just us. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very important film for me. And I wrote about all this for Ain't It Cool. And a couple days later, Drew McWeeny, who was on the editors on the site, said, hey, Steven Spielberg's people want to get a hold of you. And I don't have it here. I should have brought it. Y'all could see it. He wrote me a letter.
Oh, wow.
Saying how much he appreciated the review. And, and one of the things he put on the bottom of the letter, P.S., you are a very good writer.
Oh, my gosh. That's so cool.
Steven Spielberg wrote that on a letter, and I've got it framed.
Fucking put it on my tombstone.
Like, I don't even have it. I don't even have it hanging out because I don't want it to get bleached in the light. So it's in my closet. So that for all those reasons, that's the most important film of my life, and
amazing,
and will always be the most important film of my life.
That is amazing.
That's a good answer, and it's a movie. Well done.
Yes, that's Tim's favorite. Tim, question four.
Question number four. What is the geekiest thing you have ever done or said?
That might be it. that might be it. That's a real hard question. Ooh, the kitty cat behind you. that's a real hard question because I've done a lot. You know, I can't lie. The opportunities that Ain't It Cool gave me, I was able to interview Keanu Reeves. I was able before all the crap happened to him, I went to Pixar twice and met John Lasseter. A lot of stuff. So it's really hard to parse that. But probably the biggest geeky thing that ever happened was the Spielberg letter. That's kind of hard to top, especially because he's my all-time favorite filmmaker. Him and Akira Kurosawa are my all-time favorite filmmakers. And for that to happen, I still would love to do that interview. And if I ever get a chance to interview him, that would be a blessing. I would love to do that.
That's awesome. All right. And finally, question five, what is your favorite hangover cure?
So I don't drink much.
Yeah.
So sleep, probably.
Sleep.
Yeah. So
that's the tried and true. Do you drink a glass of water before you go to sleep, or?
Yeah. Well, you know, I've never been a big drinker. I don't like hangovers. The hangover to me is always worse than the feeling of inebriation. So I can't do that. When I do drink, it's mostly beer and mostly with Mexican food. I like having beer with Mexican food.
Maybe the Mexican food is the cure. Maybe it's just, it's the preventative. There you go.
It's fun. It's funny because when we go to the, when Tim and we go to the Christmas thing, they're always talking about, oh, my favorite liquor here, my favorite bourbon, my favorite scotch. Cargill's really experienced in that.
Oh yeah, he is.
It all tastes like gasoline to me.
There you go.
That's
there
why you and Tim are friends. There, I got it. No, I got it.
There you go.
Yep.
So, I did a podcast
with Cargill about whiskey, and he tried to get me to like it. It did not work.
Yeah.
I can't imagine.
I mean, there are different types of beer. I can enjoy different types of beer, but whiskey is like, no, it all ends in heartburn.
That's true. It all ends in heartburn. The Alan Cerny story.
Yeah, that's the name of the episode. It all ends in
all right. Well, thank you so much, Alan. Alan, you can find him on Vital Thrills and on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
Anywhere else?
Yes, I have my podcast. It's called Matinee Heroes, and you can find it on the Patreon. And we've done about like 170 episodes so far.
Hey, nice.
Like my most recent episode will be Angels with Dirty Faces, but we have a pretty big catalog. So please explore that and enjoy it. I think you'd have a lot of fun.
Matinee Heroes, available on all platforms, I'm guessing. Yeah.
Yep, it is.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you so much. We've been Geeks Without God. As always, if you want to donate to our Patreon, we'd love to have you as a supporter. We actually have a new supporter.
What?
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks to Miranda Richards, who has decided to join us.
All right.
And if you are a $2 or above, you've been watching a video of this. Ooh, very fancy. otherwise, if you are a supporter, you got to hear this early. And if you want to answer our five questions, you can send or excuse me, if you want to ask us five questions, that's what we need right now. If you want to ask us five questions, send your questions to 5questions@geeksithoutgod.com. We are running low. We'd love to have some. So hit us up. Anything.
Any five questions will do.
No question too big or too small. You don't have to do a theme. I know there's been a lot of people who did themes. Don't feel like overwhelmed by that. You can do it. I believe in you. otherwise, we will see you next Tuesday. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Remember, the next time you go to a movie in a movie theater, you'll be dead.
We're geeks. We're geeks. We're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Need more Geeks Without God? Go to our website, read our blog posts, find us on Facebook, or follow us on Twitter @GeeksWithoutGod.
Social media!
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
I remember Alan saying some atheisty shit. Let me ask him if he wants to.